First on the docket, former officer Derek Chauvin, that's right, the officer charged in the death of George Floyd, wants his charges dismissed. And you may say, oh my gosh, Scott, everyone has seen the video of George Floyd. It's obvious and it's apparent that George Floyd died at the knee of the officers in this particular case. Well, guess what? We've talked about other officers in this case who have filed motions alleging the same thing that George Floyd attorney is asking the court to do. And what former officer Derek Chauvin, through his counsel, is asking for is for the judge to drop all the charges. And their argument is, hey, judge, this man who was 46 years old at the time of his death died of a drug overdose not caused by the officer planting his knee in the back of Mr. Floyd's neck. Mr. Chauvin's attorney is a gentleman by the name of Eric Nelson. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you may not like this. You may say, no, these officers killed Mr. Floyd. This attorney is doing his job. He has support behind this theory that he is submitting to the court. Now, I think ultimately it will not be the court dismissing these charges, but ultimately if a jury decides whether Mr. Floyd died because of his own conduct or that of the police officers will ultimately be the decision of the jury. Now, quick recap. Mr. Chauvin is charged with second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. He's pled not guilty to all the charges. Now, according to filings made on behalf of Mr. Chauvin, through his counsel, it is alleged that then-Officer Chauvin was acting upon his training, the training that he received from the Minneapolis Police Department in the use of maximal restraint techniques and did so out of concern that Mr. Floyd might harm himself or the officers as they were struggling to arrest him. The Minneapolis Police Department's own policy states that maximal restraint technique says it, quote, shall only be used in situation where handcuffed subjects are combative and still pose a threat to themselves, officers, or others, or could cause significant damages to the property if not properly restrained, end quote. And Mr. Nelson, Mr. Chauvin's attorney, included that quote, as well as other training materials as it related to this maximal restraint techniques. Now, Mr. Nelson argued on behalf of Mr. Chauvin in his motion that the training materials appear to contradict a statement made shortly after the incident by the Minneapolis police chief that he had not seen anything that says you place your knee on someone's neck when they're face down and handcuffed. And Mr. Chauvin's conduct basically states is that any risk created by Mr. Chauvin conduct lies largely with those who train the Minneapolis Police Department officers and those who approve such training and not Mr. Chauvin since he was just following his training. Now, where this is really going to get exciting is that Mr. Nelson, on behalf of Mr. Chauvin, also cited the autopsy conducted on Mr. George Floyd that found that fentanyl and methamphetamine in Mr. George Floyd's system, a combination of drugs that Mr. Chauvin says is known as a speedball. He also specifically noted in his pleadings that the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's postmortem report showed that Floyd had hypertensive heart disease, hypertension, and sickle cell trait. Floyd also purportedly told the officers that he had contracted COVID-19 and was still positive for the virus at the time of his death, which was confirmed during the autopsy. Mr. Chauvin's attorney states simply, Mr. Floyd could not breathe because he had ingested a lethal dose of fentanyl and possibly a speedball. Combine this with sickle cell trait, his pre-existing heart conditions, Mr. Floyd's use of fentanyl and methamphetamine most likely killed him, not Officer Chauvin, as his attorneys argued. The attorneys stated, adding fentanyl and methamphetamine to Mr. Floyd's existing health issues was tantamount to lighting a fuse on a bomb. the attorney also added a footnote quoting the Hennepin County medical examiner, Dr. Andrew Baker, saying, quote, if Mr. Floyd were found dead at home, alone, and no apparent causes, this could be acceptable to call an OD, an overdose, end quote, ladies and gentlemen. Now, a lot of people aren't going to like this stuff, but these are facts. People always say, oh, attorneys are just out there making stuff up. No, and I guarantee you, as I've stated before, these officers are going to have experts that are going to come in and state that the drug use of Mr. Floyd, his pre-existing medical conditions, were a significant factor, and that you cannot say that these officers caused the death of Mr. Floyd. Now, the prosecutor will probably argue that it, even if that was there, even if those drugs were there, that's not what killed him, and that these officers are still somewhat negligent, or may say reckless manslaughter, because they didn't call the police early enough. Now, the problem with that particular argument is that the prosecutor has locked themselves in based upon all the hype of this particular case early on, saying that these officers actually killed Mr. Floyd. Now, we know the family of Mr. Floyd, through his attorneys, brought in some heavy-duty pathologists to say that this it was a homicide, which completely contradicted the official medical examiner's version. The medical examiner ultimately did modify his position a little bit, stating it was in fact a homicide, but the reality of it is this will be a battle of the experts, and a jury is going to have to decide whether Mr. Floyd was killed or whether Mr. Floyd was somewhat at fault based upon his drug use in this particular case. Taking fentanyl would certainly cause one to breathe. And as you may recall, the video from the body cams that were released showed that Mr. Floyd was complaining about not being able to breathe prior to ever being placed in the car or on the ground. I'm sure the defense attorneys are going to argue that was a symptom of the fentanyl use, and that that is what is responsible for the death of Mr. Floyd. And the prosecutors, in response to the motion that was filed, stated that they're going to seek an upward sentencing departure from state judicial guidelines if the defendants are found guilty. That trial is currently scheduled for March of 2021. We'll see how that goes, whether it proceeds or not, since many, many states are on limited schedules as it relates to the COVID-19 matter. Other officers have made the same argument that Mr. Chauvin has in this particular situation. Their position is basically that they were actually acting in Mr. Floyd's best interest because he was acting erratically, resisting arrest, and they were concerned that he was going to injure himself by falling or hitting his head on the sidewalk or being struck by oncoming vehicles or even injuring himself in the squad car. Mr. Chauvin is also stating that he was clearly being cautious about the amount of pressure he used to restrain Mr. Floyd, and he actually pointed out in the video where he was able to raise his head several times while he was prone on the ground. I assure you, the attorney, although he's probably watched these videos hundreds of times, they have expert witnesses, and these are laying out the arguments that the experts were going to make at trial. I believe the judge will ultimately say these are questions of fact that need to be decided by a jury. Either way, that argument is going to upset somebody. Can you imagine if a judge were to throw out those charges? I don't think that any judge has the chutzpah to throw out those charges and leave it to a jury. And then a jury is going to have to decide. And oftentimes, jurors are under a lot of pressure from what would happen in the community. Obviously, we've seen what's happened in the community, but that's why I think that this trial needs to be televised from beginning to end so that people can see and hear the evidence. And if a jury returns a verdict for guilty or not guilty, people can understand how the decision was reached. Next on the docket, Chad Daybell. As we know, the now spouse of Lori Vallow, who is probably safer in custody than if he was out of custody, particularly if Lori Vallow was out of custody. Well, he had his preliminary hearing a couple weeks ago. You can hit the link below. That will take you to the preliminary hearing if you would like to watch it in its entirety with some brilliant commentary by me as you go through it. Well, the matter has been set for trial, which doesn't go until after the first of the year. Well, motions are coming due in this particular case, and according to the Idaho rules of procedure, basically 35 days from the date of the arraignment to file any motions. Well, John Pryor, the attorney for Chad DeBell, has filed a motion to dismiss with the district court judge, and the basis of his motion is that there was not sufficient evidence presented at the preliminary hearing that was heard on August 3rd and 4th, and therefore the matter should go away. Now, there are the four felony counts, conspiracy to commit destruction, alteration or concealment of evidence, and two felony counts of destruction, alteration or concealment of evidence. At the preliminary hearing, a magistrate judge by the name of Judge Eddins determined that the special prosecutor, Ron Wood, had presented enough evidence for the case to be bound over to the district court. Now, let's get something straight. If I had filed a motion to dismiss in every case, I would be laughed at. I would have no credibility with the judge whatsoever. Most clients believe that why don't you just file a motion to dismiss for lack of evidence, or that the complaining witness is an absolute untrustworthy individual. That's not the way it works, ladies and gentlemen. Really, the only one that can file a motion to dismiss is the prosecutor. The defense can file it. You can file a motion for anything, but it's going to be denied. The preliminary hearing was the hearing to be used as a screening device to make sure that probable cause existed. Now, we've talked about this lots of times here on Crime Talk. That preliminary hearing is simply a hearing where, in most cases, the detective gets up and regurgitates what's in the affidavit for the arrest warrant, where the judge has previously found probable cause. It's very unlikely that another judge is going to not find probable cause unless the prosecutor fails to present some evidence to support each allegation that they are alleging in the complaint and information. So, very highly unlikely. I would probably fall out of my chair in shock if this judge granted the motion to dismiss filed by the district attorney. The judge will more than likely say, I appreciate this, but this is a determination that I am not going to make. There's probable cause. This is a question of fact now for the jury to decide. The legal standard has been met. The jury will decide if Chad DeBell and Lori Vallow are guilty of the delay, destruction, hindrance of evidence related to the deaths of JJ and Ty Lee. The judge is not going to step in as a 13th juror and says, yep, insufficient evidence, make this case go away. Not going to happen. He's not going to make that legal determination. He's going to say, denied, you had your day in court, the judge found probable cause, I'm not going to disturb it. This is a matter for the jury to hear. We'll see what happens. I've been wrong before, but I don't think I'm going to be wrong on this time. I don't believe that I'm going to be wrong on this issue. Next on the docket, remember yesterday, Chad DeBell's attorney had filed a motion to dismiss the charges against him because there was insufficient evidence. And I gave an explanation as to why that motion is going to be denied. That's right. Denied. Well, guess what? The prosecutor, Mr. Brown, is not concerned about that motion at all. They've met the legal standards. The sufficiency of proof is sufficient to go forward, and a jury will decide whether Lori Vallow and Chad DeBell are guilty of the crimes charged. Now, the prosecutor has filed a motion of his own yesterday, and that was a motion for joinder. Right now, the case against Lori Vallow and Chad DeBell are separate. They have separate case numbers. They were not charged as co-defendants in the same case. Therefore, the court has to grant permission for these cases to be tried together. Now, this is a motion for joinder, to join the two cases together. It makes sense. You have two defendants. The evidence is literally identical as it is to each of the co-defendants. There have been no statements made by either one of the defendants, Lori Valla or Chad Daybell. Some admissions will come in, but if they establish a conspiracy, these evidence is going to come in together under the hearsay exception for a co-conspirator statement. But there's been no statements pointing the fingers at each other. Therefore, that is why this motion for joinder will be granted. Only if Lori Valla or Chad Daybell, through their attorney, file motions and state that we have inconsistent defenses. Judge, we can't go to trial together because we're going to be throwing each other under the proverbial bus, and it would be unfair for me to do that basically with the co-defendant sitting next to me. That would be unfair, is what they will argue. Only if there is an affirmative statement by the defense saying, we are totally going to throw the other one under the bus, will there be any chance of this motion for joinder not being granted by the court. At least this way, when it's granted, Lori and Chad will be able to spend a little time together. You know, they haven't been able to do that for a while. And this may be the last time for at least the next 10 years or so that they do get to spend that time together. Next on the docket, Chad Daybell. That's right, and Lori Valla. Now, yesterday we talked about the motion for joinder that was filed by the prosecution. Well, the judge also signed another order. He gave an order granting Chad Daybell to have produced at his own expense the transcript for the preliminary hearing. Now, as you may recall, this preliminary hearing went on for a good 2 days, roughly 6 hours each day. And you can actually find a link below where you can watch the entire preliminary hearing and with some commentary thrown in by me as things go along. Now, a lot of people think that you just get these preliminary hearing transcripts or any transcripts for free. No, you don't. A court reporter has to prepare them. And you would think, well, how difficult could that be, right? They're taking notes up there with their shorthand that they use on their little stenography machine. Yeah, no. Most people don't realize this, but the court reporters usually get to hear that testimony about three times because they hear it in court, they're taking it down the best they can, and the really good ones do it in real time, and they try to make corrections as they go on the computer at that time. But then they have to go back and listen to it again, usually, or review their notes to make sure everything's correct, and they oftentimes have to proof it yet again. So they get to listen to that testimony three, four times before the final transcript goes out. Now, who pays for that? Well, if the client is court-appointed, the state pays for that. In a private case, however, you can order the transcript and you can rush an expedited transcript, which costs more money. But the average going rate, at least that I'm familiar with, is anywhere between $3 to $3.50 per page. So a two-day transcript of this hearing could cost roughly $3,500 to about $5,000. And of course, who's going to pay that? Chad Daybell. It's coming out of his trust account or what is left of it after the attorneys go through it for billing for their time as well as expenses. And I guarantee you, Mr. Pryor is not going to pay for that transcript on his own, hoping to get paid. He's only going to do it if he's been paid the costs up front. Now, as we mentioned yesterday, the prosecution filed their motion for joinder. That is to have both cases of Lori Valla and Chad Daybell heard at one time in one particular trial. Well, the motion was filed, and then today the brief in support of it is filed, and bam, just like I had stated it would, is that under the rules of criminal procedure, two or more defendants may be charged on the same complaint, indictment, or information if they are alleged to have participated in the same act or transactions or in the same set of acts or transactions constituting an offense or offenses. Now, here, The complaints were filed in separate cases. However, the court can join those indictments or informations if they have alleged to have participated in the same transaction. And obviously, that is the state of the evidence here, is that Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell participated in the same alleged transaction, which was criminal in nature. The district attorney goes on in their brief, citing that joint trials are particularly appropriate when co-defendants are charged with a conspiracy. As we noted yesterday, obviously this is a conspiracy. The evidence is nearly identical, and to have a single joint trial would be efficient for the court. It's what they refer to as judicial economy. And frankly, it just makes sense not to have to do this twice unless there's some overall compelling reason for the court to do so. As we stated, normally it's because there's conflicting defenses, which means they would have to point at each other. But everything so far seems to point to the fact that they're running a general denial, which is, we didn't know the children were there. We have no idea. How could that have happened? We have no idea. That's what they're saying, general denial. And in this particular case, the prosecutor notes that Lori Daybell's case was assigned to a different judge than Chad Daybell's case, and assigning the defendant's case to two separate judges will create an undue burden on the state by requiring repetitive work and hearings. They also note that the victims and living relatives of the deceased minor children are also prejudiced if they have to attend, and if they desire to attend, all the hearings they have a right to attend pursuant to victims' rights statute. The prosecutor also notes that this is a high-profile case, and the workload it will present to the court and the judges that preside over these cases could be overwhelming. However, judicial economy, efficiency, and consistency will be better served by consolidating these cases to one judge. We'll see what the response is when the defendants have to file their response, usually within 7 days, and we'll see if they make any of the same arguments that I anticipate that they will make. Ultimately, I think the court is going to grant this motion to join, and the case will be consolidated, and they'll set it for one trial. We'll see how things develop. And only one thing on the docket today. That's right. Chad Daybell's attorney, John Pryor, has filed a motion to change venue. Now, you file a motion to change venue when you don't believe that you can actually receive a fair trial in the county in which the case is currently being tried. Now, I can tell you, I've dealt with this issue before, and I had a change of venue granted because it was a small community and everybody had heard of it. And the judge immediately granted our motion for change of venue. Here, it's also been hinted that John Pryor firm has hired a surveying company from Boise to come in and conduct a survey and find out what people think about the Chad Daybell, Lori Vallow case matter in Fremont County. That will be used so that you can present statistical information. When you do a change of venue motion, you usually attach and say, here's the county, here's the population, here's the registered voters that are eligible to be potential jurors, and this percentage of the population has already formed an opinion that the defendants are in fact guilty. You also want to attach a lot of news media organizations, print material, videos, anything you can show that there's been overwhelming material. Now, so the district attorney has not responded yet because he'll have 14 days to respond to Mr. Pryor's motion. Mr. Pryor has also suggested that a briefing schedule be set so that the court can hear evidence regarding the change of venue motion. This motion by the defense may have some merit given the small community in which the jury pool may be coming from. If the court grants the motion for change of venue, the judge usually notifies the Chief Justice in that state, and then that judge will appoint a venue for the trial to take place. The judge will remain the same. The prosecutor will remain the same. The defense attorneys will remain the same. It will only be in a different location. Thanks for watching. That's a quick update for all of your Lori Vallow and Chad Daybell information and analysis. Tune into Crime Talk.